Welcome to this ABC Radio National podcast. For more on other enjoyable and informative programs, listen after the end for details. But right now, here's your podcast, which we hope you enjoy.
September 1952. Modern man is the victim of this era.
War.
Rumours of war.
Too much government.
Atomic devastation.
Economic uncertainty.
Today, countless factors are taking their psychic toll in your patients.
Dexedrine
lifts your patient out of the gloom of depression and helps him face the future. Dexedrine, the antidepressant of choice.
The more things change, the more they stay the same, hey? Especially in a week like this one, as people watch their stock through fated eyes. Natasha Mitchell on ABC Radio National, welcome to All in the Mind. Today on the show, boom and bust of another variety. Speed, uppers, Benny, Goey, ice, whatever you call it, the history of amphetamine is a history of highs and lows, and the making of what some describe as a long love affair between drug makers and modern medicine.
There's something in our culture, I think particularly American culture, even more than Australian culture, that makes people want it.
Pulse 110. Blood pressure 140 over 90.
There's a state that amphetamine produces that's sort of very outgoing, aggressive, self-involved, and it can be very effective in sort of the business world to be that way, to be switched on, go-getter, hustler. And as long as culture values that state, there's going to be a demand for amphetamine and other drugs that produce that type of stimulation.
Mm.
And it's fundamentally kind of antisocial.
Nick Rasmussen is Associate Professor in the History of Science at the University of New South Wales, and he's just written a compelling biography of a drug with a triumphant but fraught career, On Speed, The Many Lives of Amphetamine. And Nicholas is my guest on the show today.
009, 500 milligram dose administered. Experiment begins.
Well, Nicholas Rasmussen, thanks for joining us on ABC Radio National.
Thank you for having me.
Look, this story of amphetamines through the 20th century, it's really the story of the making of modern medicine, as you suggest. I mean, you in effect say that amphetamines encapsulates America's love affair with pharmaceuticals. In what way?
There's a cultural dimension to that. You know, we expect pills to solve our problems of living. But also, the story of amphetamine is in a way a typical story for a successful pharmaceutical. It was a miracle drug, hailed as an equal contribution to medicine as insulin when it came out in the 1930s. It was the first modern antidepressant, in fact, the first modern mental health drug, a specific corrective to a brain imbalance. Right? It's the first drug that was perceived and marketed in that way.
This was an era of kind of cocaine-based cure-alls and nerve tonics and all sorts of other concoctions and remedies, wasn't it?
Yes, before the regulation that comes in most developed countries around the beginning of the 20th century, you could buy a tonic that contains, morphine that could kill you if you drank the whole thing or make you addicted very easily. You could buy a snuff that contained pure cocaine. They would sell them off the back of a rail car. You'd go to a chemist and you'd find side by side with, the ergot alkaloids that are prescribed for migraines in much the same way 100 years ago as they are now, you'd find right next to them a tonic claiming to contain radium that would cure any cancer. Fortunately, it didn't contain any radium because, of course, radium causes cancer. There wasn't a very clear distinction in the public's mind between prescription drugs, home remedies, and recreational drugs.
Where did the life of amphetamines begin? Introduce us to a young chemist called Gordon Allies.
Well, in 1929, Gordon Allies had recently completed his PhD in biochemistry at Caltech, California Institute of Technology, and he had hopes for an academic career as a biochemist. But the Great Depression had come along, and so he found work with an allergist making pollen shots, and on the side, he searched for new synthetic chemicals that might become successful drugs. Since he worked at an allergist, he was aware of the need for new asthma medicines to replace adrenaline. You'd have to take an adrenaline shot with an asthma attack in those days. And so made chemical derivatives of adrenaline, one of which was amphetamine.
In effect, he became his own guinea pig, didn't he?
Well, he used guinea pigs, too. He tested the stuff on guinea pigs to find out what the lethal dose was, and then he gave himself quite a big dose. It was about 50 milligrams by injection. And that was the first amphetamine experience. And he was looking for, you know, the notes say, oh, sinus is clear. But then you get, you know, mind racing from one subject to another, sleepless night, that kind of thing.
Much more than an old decongestant.
That's right.
059. Temperature 98.6. Pulse 68.
But it wasn't clear at the time what it could be marketed for, this invention. He kept looking for new variants, asthma drugs, and on the way invented ecstasy, a close relative of amphetamine. But he did think there was some promise in amphetamine, and he sold it to a drug company, Smith, Kline & French. They were sort of falling behind in the game of pharmaceuticals by the 1920s, which was the game was science, find scientific new remedies that could actually improve medical care. And so they didn't have much of their own research capacity, and that's why they're interested in a new invention from an unknown biochemist in California. And they sold it almost immediately, and it's 1932 or so, I think it probably went on the market, as an inhaler. You just pop open this tube and breathe straight amphetamine vapors into your nose, and that shrank the tissue and worked as a decongestant.
And amphetamine became, in effect, a drug looking for a disease, didn't it, as one observer's put it? How did they set about finding a disease or several diseases?
Smith, Kline & French wanted to find a big market, and so they looked at common diseases that, you know, might plausibly be treated by an adrenaline derivative. And they tried it out on a huge range of conditions, menstrual cramps, bedwetting, you name it. It turns out to work for bedwetting if you give it to little kids who have that problem, probably by making sleep shallower, but also in psychiatry for depression. And that's what really caught on. They tried it for an enormous range of conditions through medical experts. And the clinical trials where the drug didn't work out well weren't published, because that was already the arrangement then. When a drug company funded a trial, unless it fit their marketing needs, the results wouldn't be published.
We didn't hear about it. You've described this as the twilight age for big companies like Smith, Kline & French. Also a golden age of innocence. Why?
Well, it's the drug industry. The drug industry didn't have to deal with scientists before, because they could just sell their, you know, nerve tonics and whatnot without having any sort of science behind it, but not by the 1920s. And so that created a demand. Drug companies had to buy in the academic science that they needed to not just to discover new drugs, but to demonstrate that they were effective in clinical trials. And so they developed quite rapidly in the 1920s a network of clinician investigators they could pay at academic medical centers to do studies designed by the drug companies. This is something that activists today find disturbing, and there certainly are some disturbing consequences when drug companies control the research on human subjects.
Pulse down to 34.
August 1943. Benzedrine sulfate, a milestone of medical history. A decade or so ago, pharmacology had scarcely envisioned a non-narcotic drug capable of alleviating depression, that common spectre of mankind. Yet today, the medical profession has in its hands just such a therapeutic weapon.
But it did work, according to a Harvard professor of psychiatry, for treating depression. And so very quickly that became the lead indication, as they say now, for amphetamine. It became quite quickly the first antidepressant.
Well, this was Professor Abraham Myerson, I gather. He was a huge figure, wasn't he, in the popular transformation of amphetamines at this time?
He was a very well-respected psychiatrist. He was he wrote The Nervous Housewife about why hysteria is so common. This is in the 1920s among married women. And the answer to that was that they, a bit of a feminist, really, they were frustrated. Their natural drives to action in the world were frustrated by this kind of enclosed role in the family. But he had a peculiar theory of depression that not a lot of other psychiatric experts agreed with at the time. The general view of depression was one of nervous exhaustion. You'd been working too hard, you lacked nervous energy. But according to him, depression was a frustration of drives and a lack of pleasure. A drive is a perhaps instinctive or deep-rooted kind of activity that seeks a certain type of reward in the world. And when you learn that your drives will never be fulfilled, you stop pursuing rewards. And that, to him, was depression. Anhedonia, a failure of the pleasure centers.
And what did he think amphetamines might do? Because he did a number of trials, as you suggest.
And he tried it on the kind of anhedonic, mildly depressed patients that were seeing him, sort of Boston elites and so on. He felt it pretty much proved his theory that by restoring drives, people got happier.
It's the zest effect.
That's right. The popular book was called When Life Loses Its Zest.
So the drug had found its disease.
Yes, and it went with a very elaborate theory, too, beyond just this anhedonia thing. He was, Meyerson was a believer in hormones controlling mood and other brain activities. The neurophysiologists were still debating whether adrenaline and acetylcholine, the first neurotransmitters, played any role in kind of higher mental functions. So to him, it also confirmed his suspicions that adrenaline must play a role in mood and another higher psychiatric function.
Mild depression and anxiety, now that was a market waiting for a drug like amphetamine.
Yes, the drug company Smith, Kline & French, they marketed it for depression, drawing on Meyerson's studies, but they also marketed his theory of depression. And these are quite large advertising campaigns in all the biggest medical journals. It was surprising the extent to which the pharmaceutical industry and the highest level of academic medical research, you know, were interwoven, even as far back as the 1930s. The two have co-evolved, really, modern medical science and the drug industry. And it's not going to be that easy separating them when you've got a more than 50-year history of kind of codependence.
You know, when we think of the so-called kiddie speed or Ritalin being used to treat attention deficit disorder today at astronomical levels, I was really surprised to read that testing amphetamines on kids started as far back as the 1930s. Right at the beginning of the life of the actual drug.
Yes, it was tested on kids that we describe now as having learning disabilities in reform schools and that kind of thing. And the most famous test that at the Bradley Home, this is sort of a home for wayward children in Rhode Island, where a large proportion of the kids with disruptive behavior in class did better on amphetamine, while others, who were apparently the same, did worse. And Bradley, the psychiatrist who did this trial, couldn't work out what was it about the kids that responded positively to amphetamine that separated them from those that didn't. This is now regarded retrospectively as the discovery of attention deficit disorder and at the same time stimulant medication for it, but actually it wasn't marketed for that at the time. Probably because Bradley thought the kids had some sort of brain damage that affected their brain waves, and it's not a kind of a good way to market a drug if you say, oh, does your kid have brain damage? Well, maybe they need amphetamines.
Or maybe they didn't. And of course, today there are concerns over the use of Ritalin, a stimulant medication for children diagnosed with ADHD. And more on that in a tick.
Where are we? Won't be long now.
Historian of science Professor Nicholas Rasmussen is my guest on All in the Mind today. He's just written a history of one of the world's most notorious illicit and legal drugs, speed. You're with ABC Radio National, across the seas and skies on Radio Australia and as podcast. In all this, Smith, Kline and French really strongly resisted, didn't they, all suggestions that amphetamines were addictive. And they cultivated experts that said as much as well.
Yes, yeah, just as they cultivate experts that find out good things about a drug, you know, that show that it works for a particular condition in their trials. They also cultivate experts that can defend drug against its detractors. And so they cultivated a certain pharmacologist named Maurice Sievers, an expert on addiction, to try to argue that the drug is in fact not addictive. Sievers' way of doing this was by coming up with a particularly narrow definition of addiction, so it really only applied to narcotics. Interestingly, Sievers became a major consultant to the tobacco industry in later years and played a crucial role in the early 60s Surgeon General's report in the U.S., preventing nicotine from being recognized as addictive in that report.
Right. Scientist for hire. World War II then hits, the Germans attack Poland. You suggest that this was a war powered by amphetamines as much as it was by machine.
Top scientists in both the US and the UK studied for 2 years the effects of amphetamine on psychomotor coordination and visual discrimination and so on. They used the latest methods, statistical analysis and so on. And despite all this, the less they were able to demonstrate that methamphetamine was any better than caffeine. And I think it was a bit of a charade calling it a drug for fatigue. I think the main reason it was chosen over caffeine was because of its mood-altering effect. Soldiers, you know, had better comportment. They marched with greater snap and zest. They showed a more aggressive and confident attitude. They'd fly their planes into heavy flak. They would take all kinds of crazy risks.
These were studies that were actually being done in the field on soldiers in combat. The wartime total of tablets taken by soldiers in combat was astronomical. You've tried to do the stats, haven't you?
Yes, I'm still working on trying to get an accurate answer for that. I believe it's over 100 million, closer to 200 million for the US. The British military consumed 70-some million, according to official totals during the course of the war. But the British cut back later in the war, whereas the Americans kept pouring it on. I have a speculative explanation, and that is that doctors in the field saw amphetamine as a remedy or a preventative for what they called combat fatigue. Well, combat fatigue was a euphemism for psychoneurotic breakdown, war neurosis, as the psychiatrists called it at the time. Unsympathetic British generals called it a failure of moral fiber. So basically, when men couldn't fight anymore, if they weren't court-martialed, they were sent to a hospital as a psychiatric case. But since amphetamine keeps you fighting longer, it could be seen as a remedy or a preventative that would stave off combat fatigue.
Yes, and so, this, of course, was the era, the war that introduced psychiatry to combat, wasn't it?
Tomorrow.
You, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
I, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
That you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
Let's come to post-war, or even towards the end of the war, actually. When did it become apparent back home, away from the war front, that people were going on Benzedrine benders with the Benzedrine decongestant inhalers that Smith Kline French were marketing en masse?
Well, yeah, we don't have accurate numbers, but it's pretty clear from novels, from beatniks and jazz memoirs and so on, that in certain subcultures, even in the early 1940s, it was quite commonplace to take a huge dose of amphetamine from one of these inhalers. I mean, they're very easy to abuse. You could just crack one open and it would have a couple hundred milligrams of pure amphetamine base in it. And they cost nothing. You could get them at any drugstore, get them at supermarkets. And these are really hallucinogenic doses that people would take. People like Charlie Parker use them quite a lot.
This is a potent image of him at the end of a performance surrounded by empty inhaler casings.
The normal way of consuming an inhaler was to mix it in a coffee or an alcoholic beverage and just slugging it down. It tasted terrible. But you'd soon get a massive rush from that. And it would last you at least 12 hours.
And Jack Kerouac, of course, loved his Benzedrine, or his Benny, as he called it.
He picked that up from the sort of the jazz club culture in New York. He kind of really admired the black musicians and poets and so on, and wanted to sort of be part of that culture. So the beatnik culture was heavily into amphetamine in the 1940s. And those inhalers, they stayed on the market right through the 50s into the 60s. The Beatles got their first major drug experience from one of these inhalers. It was just enormously popular, and we don't even keep track of that. But the amount of amphetamine pills consumed in the 50s and 60s was also huge.
Out we jumped in the warm, mad night, hearing a wild tenor man's bawling horn across the way going, ee-yah, ee-yah, and hands clapping to the beat, and folks yelling, go, go, go.
The Cool Rebellion, a study of the Beat Generation.
Amphetamines weren't being abused or used by subcultures alone. They became a mainstream medicine. They're used for antidepressants. Weight loss pills, that was an extraordinary story too. Speed as a diet pill.
That comes in right after the war, official approval for amphetamine as a diet pill. As a artificial adrenaline, it suppresses the appetite. You know, when you're being chased by lions, you don't have much appetite. But it creates all the same psychiatric effects while you're losing weight, and it can lead to addiction and psychosis, just like it would be if you're eating a Benzedrine inhaler or injecting methamphetamine. The numbers are quite astronomical. I mean, there's supposed to be a methamphetamine epidemic in Australia now. There were twice as many people, twice as large a proportion of the population, taking amphetamines in the US and the UK in the 1960s, and the great majority of that was from their doctors.
Was all this sort of explosion of sort of indications for amphetamines, like weight loss, was that all caught up with the quest by the company, Smith Kline French, to race for new applications, because of course their patent on amphetamine was about to expire in 1949, wasn't it? And that causes a sort of crisis of confidence for most big pharma companies.
Well, they did do their best to anticipate this problem of their patent expiring in 1949. They pushed forward the weight loss indication as quickly as they could, and they managed to establish their brands of amphetamine, benzedrine and dexedrine, as leading weight loss drugs. They also changed the appearance of the pills so that even though the chemical in them wasn't patented, they had a very distinctive triangular-shaped pill that if anyone imitated that, they could be pursued for a sort of trademark-type violation. And they remained the dominant force in amphetamines for at least another decade after their patent expired. So it's a success story in terms of drug marketing.
Even John F. Kennedy swore by a rather novel amphetamine concoction.
Oh, yes. He took an amphetamine smoothie by injection. It contained placenta, all kinds of strange hormones and vitamins. And he got it from a quack doctor, a German doctor named Max Jacobson, actually known as a doctor to the stars. He treated Cecil B. DeMille and the Rolling Stones and an enormous number of celebrities with the same kind of injections.
My fellow citizens of the world,
my analyst told
me, if
well,
not,
I was right out of my
what
head,
America will described do
it
for you.
He said I'd be better dead.
He said, I don't care if it's horse piss, it's the only thing that works.
Yeah. Poor Kennedy had...
He got a jab in his first TV debate with Nixon, I gather.
He faced down Khrushchev at the Vienna conference. Matt Jacobson came along on that. He needed these amphetamines for vigor and for confidence, and the poor guy had all kinds of terrible, painful injuries, not only from World War II, where he was injured, but from childhood. He had Addison's disease, which was an adrenal insufficiency, so he would have had all kinds of weird drugs, and so he knew when it was working and when it wasn't. He wasn't going to listen to what the scientists said.
Nick Rasmussen, according to your stats, more than 10 million users in the USA were using amphetamine by 1970, mm-hmm. many of whom were addicted. Despite mm-hmm. denial by the American medical profession, it seems. So at what point did amphetamine get recast as from being a drug of choice, a miracle drug, to a social pariah, a social disease, as you've put it?
By 1960, the scientific aura had certainly worn off amphetamine. It was no longer a novel miracle drug. The drug companies had come out with replacement products that were, in many cases, very closely related to amphetamine. They were amphetamines, but they were new and patented, and so they said, this is better than amphetamine. But there was an underlying kind of patient demand there that kept the prescriptions flowing. And they became just sort of a little bit naughty, very easy to get, and so on. But they developed a bad reputation in the late 60s. There was an enormous amount of abuse of the drugs in Vietnam, along with heroin. The hippie movement. Hippies were, of course, seen as a drug problem. But actually, within the hippie movement, there was an anti-amphetamine campaign, the Speed Kills campaign, because those who believe that they're going to achieve a better utopian world through marijuana and LSD were quite hostile to amphetamine that they thought produced a kind of the antithetical high. It was an establishment high to them. It was aggressive. It was selfish. It was go, 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 and you'd never get to this, you know, Aquarian utopia with that kind of a mentality. So there was kind of a conflict between the speed freaks and the acid heads.
And things were getting really nasty in the speed freak scene.
In some of the hippie enclaves, there was, yes, a lot of violence associated with the high-dose amphetamine injection, as we see in, you know, today in Australia and other places where there's subcultures of high-dose amphetamine injection. And the addictive properties were finally being recognized by medical science, kind of forcing the ordinary doctors and their representatives, the American Medical Association, into line to admit finally that the drug might be seriously habit-forming. The British medical profession was several years ahead of the U.S. in admitting this. There was a general kind of popular outrage about drug use in Vietnam and the U.S. military giving all these soldiers, you know, a big jar of pills every year, effectively.
Government-issued dexedrine.
Government-issued dexedrine, yeah, 30 or 40 pills per man per year in theater. And, of course, they're injecting heroin and buying speed on the streets of Saigon as well. And then the UN Psychotropics Convention that comes into effect in 1971 makes it a strictly controlled substance. And the U.S., well, the story behind the scenes, I gather, is that the Nixon administration, despite lobbying from the pharmaceutical industry, was willing to let the amphetamines be restricted in this way in exchange for tightening controls on marijuana worldwide.
That all leads us to today. This is a remarkable sort of boom-bust cycle, isn't it, of a drug? You suggest we're back to the boom era. It seems to have risen from the dead, amphetamines.
As a medicine, that's right. Of course, it's been a reasonably popular drug of abuse ever since it became kind of banned as a medicine in 1971. It's come back. Of course, there's been a resurgence in its popularity on the black market, but the real resurgence has been in medicine. In the U.S., where attention deficit is more popular than anywhere else, the prescriptions almost entirely for attention deficit have provided for medical consumption of amphetamines in around 2005, 2006 that exceeded that at the peak of the original epidemic, when almost all the drugs on the street and in the doctor's office were amphetamines for mild depression and weight loss and so on. So although the populations have increased, we're seeing an enormous resurgence in less than the last decade, driven by that attention deficit indication, which isn't just for kids anymore.
Adults as well. How do you view the resurgence of amphetamine use, both legal and illegal?
Well, it's certainly a dangerous drug and shouldn't be so widely prescribed. You know, that the legal prescription of amphetamine and related stimulants leads to its illicit non-medical use, and it's addictive and a very destructive drug. So it should be much less freely prescribed, not just amphetamine, but methylphenidate and other amphetamine-related drugs. It should remain a controlled substance. In the case of Ritalin for children, now with children it's the parent that's deciding whether there's a problem that needs medication. So what's making the parent decide that? Well, it's partly the kind of situation in schools where kids aren't given the kind of individual attention that they may need, and so disruptive behavior becomes a bigger problem, you know, large class size, that kind of thing. Also, kind of focus on the achievement that's measured by percentage points.
But there's a parallel and increasing research body investigating attention deficit disorder, pointing to biological evidence for ADHD, and so then pointing to attendant medications.
Well, when you have an MRI scanner, you can always point it at somebody who's thinking something, and you see something on the screen and you say, aha, there's the part of the brain that's responsible for that mental activity. It's a modern form of phrenology. I'm not saying that attention deficit is not a condition. We don't have to define it, though, as a pathological condition. That's a kind of a social decision. And even if we accept that it's some sort of an undesirable abnormal state, we don't have to decide that it needs medication. It doesn't need a biological intervention necessarily. As if just because you find it on an MRI display, it must be real and require medication. There's a lot of illogic in that chain of reasoning that's fairly standard, at least with those who are in alliance with the drug companies.
Nick, you don't just point the finger at parents or scientists, you also point the finger at the drug industry and say that the drug industry in its normal course of business, these are your words, still generates a constant threat to society. Strong words. So how do you reflect on the pharmaceutical industry's responsibility in the resurgence of amphetamine use?
It's not to deny that important new medicines are also made by the drug industry, but we have to remember the costs of their R&D and marketing activities to the public health, as well as the benefits. And for-profit pharmaceutical companies, when they have a product that's new or patented or otherwise unique, the best way for them to sell lots of it is to expand the prescription base, to get more and more people recognized with whatever condition it is so that they'll be given the drug. And if the drug has a lot of negative side effects, and all drugs have some harmful potential, even the best ones, you're talking about a lot of people getting a drug they can't benefit from and can only be harmed.
You're suggesting that 20 million Americans are actively using speed in some form, whether it be medical or non-medical. And we've seen the rise of the ice epidemic, which is traumatizing populations in Australia as well.
I don't actually say that there's 20 million using amphetamines.
But aren't you saying that 5 million are on ADHD meds, 3 million on meth, 2 million on ecstasy, and approximately 10 million on diet pills, which may or may not be based on amphetamine?
Well, that's right. That's right. We don't know a lot about the 10 million because a lot of those diet drugs are actually not prescription drugs. Until recently, most of them were based on ephedrine, which is in a very amphetamine-like compound. So yes, at the point when ephedrine was the most popular diet drug, almost entirely non-prescription, in the early 2000s, then that 10 million figure would have held.
Nicholas Rasmussen, it's an interesting history. It sounds like you had a lot of fun interrogating the archives. Thank you for joining me on the program this week.
Oh, thank you.
5:42. Experiment ends.
Nicholas Rasmussen, professor in the history of science at the University of New South Wales, and his new book is called On Speed, The Many Lives of Amphetamine, published by New York University Press. Downloadable audio, references and the transcript all on the All in the Mind website, with the email address and my blog too. Fill it full of comments, all via abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. My thanks to co-producer Kyla Brettel, studio engineer Joel Church. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Back with you next week.
Why do half of all apprentices fail to complete their training?
When you look at pay for apprentices, slightly above the dole, pressures in relation to bringing an income in is far greater than the aspiration to come out with a qualification.
That's just symptomatic of this incredibly deep skill shortage that we face, that they get snapped up before they're qualified.
Skilling Australia, in the national interest with me, Peter Mayers. Download or stream this program from the Radio National website.